So the spontaneous movements and or walking that isn't necessarily exercise, it actually burns like about 20% of your daily calories. Exercise,
that's a lot.
Yeah,
that's
and a lot. You don't burn a lot of calories when you're doing resistance training. But yeah, like the non-exercise activity, folding clothes, doing the dishes, walking the stairs, walking, fidgeting, like tapping your feet, that also burns calories. Mm-hmm. And if you are already not a person who moves around a lot, then that can, yeah, prevent you from burning around like 500 to 700 calories per day.
Hi, and welcome back to the Mind and Psychology podcast. I'm your host, Inka Lant, and want to thank you for being here today with me and my guest. I appreciate your time and aim to bring you real insights and practical tips for wellness in every episode. So today you're actually going to meet my husband, Siim, because I'm going to interview him today. This is the second part of the episode that we started on Siim's channel, which was covering a lot of this kind of general ideas on metabolism and exercise and weight loss. I'm often asked about exercise and diet tips for women, like how to lose weight or get motivated to exercise, and also what's the best way to eat for staying fit and maintaining hormonal balance and mood. So we discussed these topics with Siim today. Siim Lant is an author, speaker, and consultant and educates people on optimizing health and performance. He has written many best-selling books on metabolism, weight loss, stress management, and health. He's a popular speaker in health conferences and has an active YouTube channel where he shares the scientific discoveries and practical advice on health and performance. In this episode, we talk about exercise and diet principles for women. For example, how to make exercise easy and motivating by adding some fun to it, how to burn a lot of calories easily at home, for example, just by increasing steps, how to easily lower blood sugar response to foods, how much and when to eat carbs, fat and protein according to exercise and menstrual cycle for the best fitness and hormonal balance. We also discuss protein composition and how eating too much red meat or supplementing with BCAA can disrupt sleep and mood and what to do about it. Join the discussion by commenting your experiences on this topic on the YouTube comment section of this video and subscribe to YouTube, Spotify and Apple Podcast channels of Mind and Psychology Podcast. Enjoy the episode. Hi everyone, this is Inka and this is my husband, Siim, and I got the privilege today to interview him about exercise, and we're going to talk about women's specific factors in exercise and weight and diet, and then we're going to talk about protein, some specifics in protein and tryptophan and serotonin and the brain. We can start with principles of how women can maintain their weight and bodily fitness. And what would you say are the principle of maintaining proper fitness?
Well, I mean, just regular exercise is obviously the most important part of that, because, you know, you don't get fitter by sitting on the couch. And even like with fasting, like you can definitely lose weight and improve your body fat levels with either like dieting and calorie restriction and like fasting and those things, but you don't ever get fitter in terms of your cardiovascular performance and muscle strength and muscle mass by just or without doing some form of resistance training and cardiovascular exercise. So that's probably the most, a lot of people tend to neglect that. So they do go on diets and they eat less and those kind of things, but if they don't add the exercise component, then they're never gonna get, you know, stronger muscles, and they don't get better VO2 max and those kind of things. And especially when it comes to like weight loss and calorie restriction, then you do need to have some form of resistance training in there to prevent becoming very sarcopenic and becoming very frail. So if you lose a lot of weight by just calorie restriction without resistance training, then your body will begin to lose a lot of the muscle tissue. And that, again, makes you more frail. Makes
and bone density.
Bone density decreases. And you actually maintain a lot more fat by being in a calorie deficit without doing resistance training. Because, you know, when your body chooses, okay, we're not really using the muscles, but we do need fat for survival. And the person you are eating in a calorie deficit, your body thinks that it's some aspects of starvation and famine that it's approaching, then obviously it's going to want to maintain the fat and it's going to lose the muscle, which again puts you in this spiral of decreasing your metabolic rate, making it harder to lose weight in the future, making you frail, increasing your chance of injury, and making you look worse as well, of having a bit of this like stubborn fat and having excess body fat without the muscle tissue that makes you look better, essentially. I think that's the critical part that many people don't know about, that just being on a diet isn't what they want, you know, it's not their actual main goal. Their main goal is to, you know, look better and lose some weight and lose fat, but the way to achieve that is to do resistance training, which is the best way to signal your body that it needs to have some muscle and lose like the weight.
Okay, so let's bust some myths. Is weightlifting bad for women?
No, I mean, like, first of all, you're not gonna get too bulky. Like, you can't get as big as a man because you don't have the testosterone. And generally, you're probably gonna stop. It's not gonna happen overnight. Like, men spend decades in the gym trying to get too bulky. They want to get too bulky, but they can't. And they already have the hormonal, like, advantage of that. But they still can't achieve that. So like men, so women who have like, you know, 20 times less testosterone and less androgens and generally less bone density and those things as well, then for them it's going to be even harder to achieve. So you're not going to become too bulky, because first of all, it's like a slow motion train wreck. Like, you see the train coming and you're like, no, I'm getting too bulky. But it's coming at like, it's gonna arrive in 2 years when you become too bulky. So you have all the time to, like, you know, not gain muscle and change your routine if you want to. So it's like a slow motion train wreck that you can see coming like 3 years away, and even then it's very unlikely that it's actually ever gonna happen.
Yes. So when women start lifting weights, I guess just to monitor the, like, don't worry about getting muscles. Muscles are good. You need those. But just monitor that you don't get too lean and start losing too much fat so that you can still produce the hormones that you need for your cycle. And how is weight loss different for men and women? Or how is exercise, let's put the whole exercise into the picture, how is exercising different for men and women? I mean, you've been coaching a lot of men and women clients on exercise. What do you think are the basic principles?
I think some of the, like, principles, like the overarching principles and philosophy, are generally the same. So you need to see progressive overload in your training, which means getting stronger over time, to see changes in your body composition and fitness.
Okay, sorry, I'm gonna ask a question about this. Do you think that we always need to see a change in body composition? What if you're already fit?
There's obviously a very different approach to maintaining fitness and muscle instead of a building. To maintain, you can get away with very little. So if you want to maintain muscle mass and what you currently have, then you just even need to, like, lift once a week, for example, and that already pretty much maintains it. If you want to build a little bit more strength and more muscle mass, or just be healthier and fitter, then more frequent exercise is generally better. So, like, at least twice a week, at least, and three times a week optimally, I think, is a good frequency.
Is this for weight loss, weight training, or aerobic, or both?
Weight training.
Yeah. So training. So definitely, if you, like, if we count the whole exercise, you need to exercise more than once a week.
Yeah.
To be and stay fit. So aerobic and strength training.
Yeah, and a lot of times, you know, people who do these super high intensity exercises only once a week and such, you get less results. So yeah, I think it's still, for most people, normal people, they want to have multiple exercise sessions per week. And it's generally healthier as well. Like, you know, you don't maintain this insulin sensitivity all throughout the entire week if you exercise only once. So you may have that insulin sensitivity for maybe 2 days max after the workout, but if you want to have, like, better biomarkers and insulin sensitivity all week, then you need to have, like, multiple sessions to maintain that. Cardio obviously is like an addition to that, the goal of cardio is to either like burn calories, help with weight loss, just to move, or like improve heart function and cardiovascular performance, VO2 max, those things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a more additional tool. So cardio doesn't really change your body composition. It like helps with calorie burn and calorie expenditure, but it doesn't signal the body to build muscle, and it can help with fat loss as well. But it's similar with the calorie restriction. If you eat, like let's say calorie restriction, you eat less calories and you do only cardio, then your body receives the same signal as it is with no exercise, that it needs to lose the muscle and maintain some of the fat. Because you know, you don't need muscle necessarily to do cardio that much. Whereas if you have the signal for resistance training there as well, then the body receives, we need the muscle tissue, which then maintains your metabolic rate. It makes you burn more calories at rest without doing anything. It makes you very insulin sensitive, so you can eat carbs with less issues. And it's generally like a mandatory part of sustainable and healthy weight loss and fat loss especially. So there's a difference between weight loss and fat loss. Like you can lose muscle and bone density, or you can lose fat. So most people generally want to lose fat, and losing fat is also generally healthier than losing muscle or bone density.
Yeah, for sure. Cardio also, like, so weights are good for the body composition, keeping your muscles strong, keeping your bones strong, joints strong. They are especially good for women because women tend to be more sarcopenic or tend to be have like a loss of bone density and joint issues and things like this. Cardio, on the other hand, is very good for the brain and the mood, and is actually one of the biggest things that improve the hippocampal growth. And women are higher at risk, for example, for Alzheimer's disease. Cardiovascular exercise, especially running and things like that, have been shown to be one of the most effective ways to build that brain reserve and make sure your brain structure and function stays very sharp. So exercise overall is super healthy and super good. There is a thing that I get often asked, which is how to get motivated to exercise. And for this, I've noticed that many people overcomplicate exercise. They think that they need to go, like, it's like exercise equals gym three times a week, 1.5 hours. Well, I don't have time for that. What to do now? So it doesn't have to be always that complicated. And plus, in addition to the gym, they think that they need to run many times a week for an hour. So let's talk a little bit about how you can motivate yourself to exercise and how you can make it easy and accessible in any circumstance in life. And maybe in the context, just many women may find themselves, you know, with the kids, with small kids, or having to do a lot of household duties, or just like being low energy because of the menstrual cycle or something like that. And then what can we do to make exercise easy and effortless?
Yeah, I think that it's important to like realize that exercise doesn't have to be like going to the gym and actual workout or getting sweaty and that kind of thing. So exercise can be any form of movement that you can do like pretty much anywhere, anytime, in different like amounts and intensities. So going for walks is obviously not necessarily exercise, but it does help with many things that you get from exercise. Like it improves your blood sugar levels, improves like weight loss a little bit, and good for the brain as well. So, you know, obviously walking around that you can do anytime, and implementing like this certain specific amount of time per day for walking is a good like habit to do. And it also like takes off some of the burden that you kind of need to have, like a super intense workout, for example. And getting it over with like in the early part of the day is also good for, like not having this like a chore of exercise in the back of your head. So you know that I need to exercise today, I haven't done it yet. So in the evening, you feel like a bit rushed. You have less time. You have, you know, more things, other things to do. And after work and stuff, like it's going to be hard to catch up. And you have like less motivation, obviously, to do that. So if you already start the day with some form of movement and you spread different movement breaks throughout the day, like taking the stairs, walking everywhere. You know, we use the treadmill desk, which is amazing that we are on the computer working.
That's a game changer.
Yeah,
really.
Doing emails, writing books with the treadmill, and yeah, you can just, in the morning, what we do is usually we walk, both of us, like when we start work, we do it for like, you know, 30-45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
That already gives you pretty much, you know, 3,000-4,000 steps per day,
easily.
And that's like almost half of the daily steps that you need. And you know, we do it multiple times as well throughout the day, maybe like shorter, 15 minutes or something. So yeah, that's already automatic.
You get your steps just, you know, during your work day.
Yeah.
And so just to explain what it is, so you have a standing desk,
mm-hmm.
so you can lift it onto your
height
level, or like you're in front of your chest. So you have your computer in front of you, and then you have a treadmill under the desk. So you walk while you're doing your job.
Mm.
Once I was, I got maybe, did I get even like 13,000 steps of just being on a line on Google support, technical support. So I was just waiting to get to the call. And I had to be in my computer because I had to explain what's happening in the computer so they can fix it.
Mm.
So that's like, I got my steps during that waiting.
Yeah, and if you have like some Zoom calls that don't require you to be quiet or something, then you can use that as well. So like annoying Zoom meetings and those kind of things. Or when you're just talking with someone, then you can get some steps doing that.
If you're watching online training.
Mm-hmm. If you're watching this podcast, for example, you can do walking, or you can listen it on your Spotify when you're in a forest or wherever.
Yeah.
Adds up, all of it. I think there is some research that do... So this called like this non-exercise activity thermogenesis, NEAT. So the spontaneous movements and exercise that or walking that isn't necessarily exercise, and that can, it actually burns like about 20% of your daily calories, whereas exercise.
That's a lot.
Yeah,
and that's a lot.
Whereas exercise burns about 10%. So like the deliberate exercise when you're doing, or it depends on which type of exercise. If you do like a, you know, HIIT cardio for an hour, then you obviously burn more calories. But like. At least resistance training. You don't burn a lot of calories when you're doing resistance training.
Mm.
You signal the body to change and adapt, to increase your basal metabolic rate and increase your insulin sensitivity. But like the non-exercise activity, folding clothes, doing the dishes, walking the stairs, walking, fidgeting, like very like tapping your feet, that also burns calories.
Mm.
And it adds up a lot. And if you are, you know, like very, let's say, restricted calorie intake, or you are not a person who moves around a lot, then that can prevent you from burning around like 500 to 700 calories per day, which, you know, is a lot. So that's almost like 100 grams of body weight per day almost. It's a good, and if you, let's say, you don't have a standing work desk, then I mean, I don't think that you have a boss that prevents you from taking movement breaks. Or you can do even like the walking and some form of movement, even in your office setting. So you should always, you know, take frequent breaks between your work sessions. Like, don't sit for like multiple hours in a row.
Mm.
That's quite bad for your mobility, as well as, prevent you from moving around. So if I were to be sitting without the standing work desk, then I would, every hour I would take like a 5-minute break where I'm moving and walking or something like that.
For sure. And even better if you can go outside to do some movement. So you get the sunlight as well and you get a fresh air.
Yeah. Like we're in the countryside, you know, and we have our own yard. So like what I do sometimes is, you know, I'm working, I haven't used the walking treadmill, then I'll go outside. I'll do like a sprint. I'll do like a 10-second, 20-second sprint somewhere and get some fresh air and then come back. And that's also very good.
Yeah, I might also go out. I might walk for like 200-300 meters and come back.
Yeah, that's very good enough if you do it multiple times per day. And one very like a beneficial thing for overall blood sugar management is to walk after the meals.
Mm.
So you have the CGM. And like you've measured, like previously we didn't walk in between our meals that much, or immediately after that. But now that you've done it. So we had like our, for dinner, we had like, you know, main course. We walked a little bit and then we had like a dessert.
Mm.
And in between those things, we both walked, and you had the CGM to show that the blood sugar response was very small in between those meals.
Mm.
And afterwards as well, because of the walking. So like, you know, 10-minute walk after every meal. There's studies, yeah, also finding that it's actually better than having like an entire 45-minute walk once a day.
Mm.
So like 3 15-minute walks are better for the 24-hour blood sugar level and insulin levels than a 45-minute walk in one go.
Mm.
So the frequency of the movement is also important, especially if you're eating multiple times a day. I would always want to walk and move a little bit after a meal.
Walk after the meal and move also before the meal. So can you explain the GLUT4 thing? And like, why do we need to activate GLUT4 before we eat something?
Yeah, so, you know, your body has obviously insulin to lower blood sugar levels and release insulin to shuttle glucose into the cells. But there's also like different glucose transporters, like GLUT4 is one of the main ones, but there's like GLUT6 and other ones. So GLUT4 like attaches to muscle cells and enables glucose to go into the cells. And it's actually increases the glucose disposal, you know, a lot. So if you exercise, then your ability to clear your bloodstream from glucose is almost like 100 times better than being sedentary. So if you, let's say, eat ice cream or eat cookies that have a lot of carbohydrates and sugars, they spike your blood sugar. If you exercise before, then the glucose response is probably very small. Whereas if you're sitting and being sedentary, then you eat the cookies, and then yeah, there's gonna be have a, like a huge spike in the blood sugar levels.
Mm.
So yeah, like sensitizing yourself to glucose, and afterwards lowering the blood sugar is kind of the order of things that you want to. Yeah, like very small amount of movement already, and muscle contraction, very light muscle contraction even, is enough to activate the GLUT4.
Like examples.
Yeah,
is it like a gym session or is it like a home session?
Well, yeah, like when you do like a gym session, then the GLUT4 probably stays activated and translocated to the muscle cells for like pretty much, you know, even
hours.
Like, yeah, many hours, 6, 7, 8 hours, 10, 12 hours, 24 hours even. But if you haven't exercised with weights and resistance training, then just like easy ways to do that is to do some like static holds. They're the most efficient way to activate.
So just to clarify,
planks.
At home, you can do, you
home.
Don't have to go to the gym before every meal.
Yeah.
You can do 5 minutes exercise at home.
Or some movement, like walking probably also helps with that a little bit.
Yeah. And I, for example, I do some sort of dances. I like YouTube dancing videos. I'm just going to be honest about it. And yeah, I like to do those before I eat. And it's actually
like a cardio dance workout.
Yeah, cardio dance workout. And it's actually a nice way to, so I do things in the morning at the work. I'm cognitively very focused, very engaged in my work. And then I want to transition to eating. And I don't want to take my all of these thoughts of work and productivity into the moment when I eat, because I want my body to be, you know, in a digestive mode. So I do a dance, it takes my head off from all of that stuff. I feel happy and, you know, in the moment. And then I go to the eat.
Mm.
So my body and my mind are both now better prepared to just eat and enjoy the moment.
Yeah. And when it comes to eating, then, you know, you need to be in a calorie deficit still to lose weight. The calorie deficit is always like subjective. Which means that, yeah, like you can increase your metabolic rate with having more muscle mass, having more exercise, doing more NEAT, and adjusting some of the macronutrient ratios of the food.
Mm.
So like low carb diets generally reduce your metabolic rate, and like too much fat, like super high fat intake, you know, it doesn't make you burn more calories. Mm. Whereas a high protein intake does like burn calories. But you want to have carbs as well to increase your thyroid and leptin function, which increases your metabolic rate. And like now, you know, I'm eating like more carbs than ever before, and I'm leaner, and I have like a higher metabolic rate, and it's much easier to lose weight as well. So I think, yeah, like the fear about carbs is a bit like a groupthink thing. or like a trendy thing that can come and go. Obviously, there's benefits to restricting carbohydrate intake periodically and at certain times of the day. But like chronic low carb intake generally, you know, lowers testosterone, lowers female hormones as well, lowers your metabolic rate, lowers leptin. So it's like chronically being low carb or being like super high protein and low carb like a carnivore diet, it just still not that optimal for hormones and the thyroid and leptin metabolic rate.
Yeah, actually we can talk a bit more. So if you want to know more about how to do weightlifting the proper way, you can listen to the first part of where we cover these basic principles. And one more thing with this exercise, how to make it easy, like do it with your partner, do something like like plank competition or go to a run together,
or I lift you up and
we have in his Instagram and mine as well, we have videos where we show when he lifts me up and it's a plank exercise for me and it's lifting for him. Also it's a little bit dangerous maybe to try in the middle.
I mean you need to have, you know, if you're you need to be strong, I guess, to do that.
And have to have a good, like, a trust to your partner as well.
But I mean, yeah, just regular, you know, you're going to have a kettlebell somewhere and do a few swings, and you're going to have some resistance bands. You can do planks, you can do calisthenics.
And if you have kids, like if you are a mother with children and you think, like, I don't have time to do exercise because I need to take care of the kids, figure out a routine that you can do the family all together. That you can do something fun. You have movement break. You can have some, like, I don't know, like some sort of fun family yoga together. And, you know, there are great, like, fun things that you can try to do. Or just have, like, make a cleaning, you know, a family movement routine. Or something like that.
Yeah. And, yeah, like teaching your kids to do some form of exercise, as well as, like, you know, teaching them about the diet is one of the best things that you can do to them. Set them off for their good health for the rest of their life.
Yeah, the example. It's like, it's beneficial also for the children to see your exercise.
Yeah, and yeah, that's actually what a lot of, you know, parents kind of fail. Like, they want their kids to be, you know, healthy and eat a good diet and such, but they don't themselves follow that. So kids learn from you the most, and if they see that you're not doing anything that improves your health, then obviously they're not going to take it seriously either. So just lead by example is the most important part.
Yes. So now I want to talk a little bit about the carbs and the protein and the fats, because women and men have pretty a lot different metabolism. There are many studies that show that fasting, ketogenic diets and stuff like that, they work differently in women and men body and leads into different outcomes. So these kind of overgeneralized principles of diet that are mainly studied with young American men do not apply to women. Women were excluded from these trials because the hormones are hard to control, and there were people were afraid that it's going to affect our fertility. And now then it paradoxically we made all the recommendation based on men, and now it's actually affecting our hormones in a negative way. So let's talk a little bit about the cycle. And so we are more insulin sensitive at the first 2 weeks of the cycle. We're better at fat and protein oxidation at the last 2 weeks of the cycle. So we may do better with heavier carbs or more carbs with the first 2 weeks of the cycle, but also our caloric needs are less. So we don't need that much calories at the time. Caloric needs increase at the last 2 weeks of the cycle when you probably need more protein and more fat. How much would you recommend for exercising women to eat protein?
Well, the maximum benefits come from like 0.7 to 0.8 grams per pound of body weight, which in kilograms is like 1.4 to 1.5 grams per kilogram. So in most women's cases, it's going to be like 70 to 100 grams of protein, something like that. That's like, you know, then you reach the threshold of or the peak of how much protein would affect your muscle growth.
How much that, or how would that look like in your plate?
So let's say like a regular fillet, chicken fillet, for example, or fish fillet, like 200 gram fillet or something, that's going to have already like 60 grams of protein. And you get protein from, you know, some vegetables and stuff like that. So like one egg has like 8 grams of protein. One cup of cottage cheese usually has like, you know, like 50 grams of protein. So it's not that hard to get such an amount. So the heavier you are, the bigger you are, the more protein you need. But women obviously are smaller and they need a bit less protein. For them it's actually relatively easy. But protein is very satiating, so it's, you know, a lot of times people find it hard to eat that much protein because it's so filling. So for that, you know, you can just have like, you have to make sure that you have every meal that you eat has some protein. So like as a woman, you would want to have like at least 25
maybe
grams.
Not every meal though, and we're just gonna talk about it in a second when we talk about
right that. But I mean, you know, at least two meals that has at least 25 to 35 grams of protein.
Yes, the main meals that you're gonna have,
like a small snack obviously doesn't always have to have protein, but that's generally the way I would structure that. And good sources are fish, chicken, cottage cheese, some meat, eggs are the highest source of protein, but obviously, you know, as a woman, tofu is great for the estrogen, and some beans are also good for the microbiome and
green beans, lentils.
Yeah, you do get actually quite a lot of protein from like vegetables and stuff as well. Like if you eat, you know, your, even if you're, let's say, every meal, 1/3 or half of your plate is some sort of vegetables and greens, then you're gonna get like 10 grams of protein from that per meal. So you're gonna,
many people don't maybe even think that vegetables have like chickpeas, green peas, everything like that has protein
a little bit. And once you reach a certain amount of protein, then the quality of the, or like, you know, the amino acid profile of it becomes less important. So if you eat like 30 grams of protein a day, then you have to make sure that it is pretty much animal protein and that you get all the essential amino acids from that. But if you eat like 130 grams of protein, for a woman that's like, you know, a lot and excess, and it's like a lot of plant-based protein, then you still get sufficient amounts of amino acids from that because you get, you know, double the amount of protein that you actually need. So obviously you are, it's very inconvenient to eat that much as a woman. And you don't need that much, but if you eat like 70 to 100 grams of protein somewhere there, then part of that is very easily able to come from like plant-based sources and including some animal proteins as well for, you know, cholesterol and choline and other things from like egg yolks. So,
So women's body uses more protein at the last 2 weeks of the cycle. So especially if you're working out, you already have increased protein needs. If you're weightlifting, and then just make sure that at the last 2 weeks of the cycle you get your protein. That's going to be very important, as well as fat. And do you have any diet hacks that make women easily to maintain their body weight or lose weight?
I mean, I think if women start to do some form of resistance training, then they would see like an improvement in their body composition without doing anything else. Like the aspect of resistance training makes them build a bit more muscle and lose fat, which just improves their, I think, all their goals that they're after. I think that's pretty much the most important, the most effective thing. Like, I don't recommend for women to be on like a low carb diet all the time either, but like maybe some form of, or allocating or timing your carbohydrate intake can also be a good strategy and effective. So, you know, if you want to avoid crashes in the afternoon, if you want to avoid big ups and downs in your blood sugar during daytime, then it's better to stay lower carb in the first half of the day, eat protein and healthy fats and like vegetables and fibers, and have the carbohydrates. Usually the best time for that is after some form of exercise, because then it's going to have the least effect on the blood sugar levels, and you know, helps with like some aspects of sleep as well.
For sure, so carbs, during the later part of the day that's going to help you with maintaining a little bit better energy levels.
Yeah.
But some women may notice that they need carbs before weightlifting, for example. So it's not, you know, again, we are bio-individual. There are a lot of individual differences, especially on diet and when it comes to diet and exercise. You need to kind of find your own flow and your body's needs, because some women, for example, are very sensitive to hormonal fluctuations.
Mm.
Other women are not.
Mm.
Like I am, so I need to be more specific about
it.
Yeah,
I guess it depends on the cycle as well, like if you need carbs before exercise.
Yeah,
like
this is what we talked about before, that at the first 2 weeks of the cycle you probably need a little bit more carbs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And well, from this is actually a good, very good transition to the topic of a little bit of the basic principles on how protein work, and especially how, you know, how important it is to understand your protein composition so that you are not bombarding any neurotransmitters benefits in your brain. I think this is very less talked, very important aspect of mental health, brain health, and especially because it's so essential for sleep.
Mm-hmm.
That we really wanted to talk about it. So the whole idea here is that if you are getting too much certain amount of amino acids from your protein,
I guess we can start with, you know, melatonin, the sleep hormone that is very, that's, you know, essential for conducting a lot of the antioxidant and anti-inflammatory processes in your sleep, and it makes you somewhat drowsy and helps you to fall asleep, get better quality sleep. And to make melatonin, you need serotonin, and the precursor for serotonin is tryptophan.
Yes, but not only. So we are gonna talk about tryptophan a lot. Tryptophan, serotonin, and BCAAs.
Mm-hmm.
So tryptophan is an amino acid, and then there are other large neural amino acids, and serotonin, as we talked, is important for making melatonin, but it's also essential for mood, the feeling of contentment, social relationships, this kind of social bonding.
Mm.
And that's why you want to make sure that your brain is producing serotonin and that the serotonin signaling is happening there. Another thing is that serotonin is one of the key neurotransmitters for learning and memory. Hippocampus is very high and abundant in serotonergic projections and serotonergic neurons, and that is pretty much what makes you and helps you learn new things, amongst other neurotransmitters, but one of the key ones. So it's made, as Sim told, it's made from the amino acid tryptophan to a conversion process. So basically, for tryptophan to become serotonin, it first goes into the brain, it's hydroxylated, and ultimately it's decarboxylated and it becomes serotonin. And there are two different pathways. So that was the first pathway, that was this serotonin pathway. And serotonin is then made into melatonin in the brain. But only 5% of the tryptophan goes into that pathway. The other pathway in the brain is tryptophan to kynurenine pathway, where is it made in different forms that can counteract stress and inflammation. So it has important roles in the brain for mood, sleep, and counteracting stress. So now then you have protein sources, and proteins are a mixture of amino acids. And here you can see in the red pathway, basically, that you have proteins, and proteins usually, let's say, piece of meat contains tryptophan, but also large neutral amino acid LNAAs. And the content of tryptophan in a basic meat source of protein is from 0.5 to 1%. And so when you eat protein, when you eat meat, for example, the relative increase in your plasma tryptophan is not very significant. And you always calculate your tryptophan intake, or in regards to brain, you need to think about how much tryptophan do you have in your bloodstream in relation to these other large neutral amino acids. Why you need to do that? You need to do it because the tryptophan access to the brain depends on the amount of these other large neutral amino acids, because they actually all compete with the same carrier for the same carrier protein that is going to transport them into the brain. And large neutral amino acids always win the race. If there is tryptophan and a lot of large neutral amino acids in your bloodstream, these large neutral amino acids will go into your brain, and the tryptophan is there, you know, left to the blood. And it's also bind to albumin in the blood. So it has the tendency to circulate there if there are other competing proteins there. So this tryptophan LNAA ratio is the important thing. The brain tryptophan amount is strongly linked to how much you get it from diet. So diet is the important source of any amino acids, basically, for the brain. But it's like studied and shown that the brain tryptophan levels depend on the dietary amount of tryptophan. It's now recommended that you get about 250 to 425 milligrams per day for tryptophan. So let's say something like milk, a glass of milk would be 180 milligrams. Like an ounce of tuna has 500 milligrams. Chicken has 240 milligrams per pound. But they're also high in this LNAA. So that tryptophan will not just go into your brain and become serotonin.
Because the amino acids are blocking it.
Yeah, because the large neutral amino acids are transported before the tryptophan. Yeah. So they compete. So now you would have to create a situation where you get tryptophan transported into the brain without having to other LNAAs to mess up this transportation system. And what the studies seem to suggest, that the way to do this is by increasing insulin. Because insulin would shuffle the BCAAs into the muscles, and then the tryptophan would get access to the brain. And
so carbs.
So now there are many studies that show that if you ingest tryptophan with carbs without other amino acids, then your brain levels of tryptophan will increase. And so what the studies show is that if you eat carbohydrates, you know, carbohydrates are actually a pretty rich source of tryptophan. Like, you don't have to get tryptophan from meat. You get tryptophan from oats, for example.
Pumpkin seeds,
actually dairy, nuts, banana. They all contain tryptophan. They are very good sources for that. So you can basically eat a cup of oats and you get this effect. But you need the insulin for that. So if you would, I don't know if it would help that you just take just a tryptophan supplement, let's say, but you wouldn't have that insulin response, because tryptophan is accumulating to the bloodstream. But yeah, you need the insulin to kind of make the other competing amino acids
go away.
Yeah. So is there any way to increase insulin without eating carbs, or just out of curiosity?
I mean, yeah, like high amounts of protein still spikes insulin.
Yeah, but taken that you cannot eat that.
Yes. But like one amino acid, especially like lysine, is also like that raises insulin, that lowers the blood sugar, but it doesn't have like obviously the other amino acids there. So glycine is alone. So it increases your insulin sensitivity. So you can take like lysine pretty much, you know, you can mix it with coffee, or you can just take one teaspoon with it, and that should raise the insulin levels as well. So you need to, or what it basically means that you need to have like a clean insulin spike without amino acids once a day to help with the tryptophan entry into the brain. So it doesn't have to be in the bedtime. You can pretty much do it at any time of the day.
Well, there are no many studies on that. Like, I found only one study, but it wasn't, it showed that you needed to have that. Then they showed that after 6 hours, this was on dogs, by the way, after 6 hours, the serotonin in the brain was increased. So actually that would have, that would be beneficial if it were close to bed then.
So like a dessert.
Yeah.
Bedtime dessert or snack that doesn't have protein.
Yeah, like the issue is actually with the studies on amino acids and tryptophan and these kind of timing things is that there is so many mixed methods. There is not a standard protocol. Mm-hmm. So I, for example, I did actually my master's thesis on tryptophan administration to sleep quality mm-hmm. on men and women. And when I looked at the literature review, the issue is that sometimes the tryptophan administration is in the morning, sometimes it's in the day, sometimes it's in several times of the day, sometimes it's with carbs, sometimes without carbs. Usually they didn't control other amino acid intake at all, so we don't actually know. But I would say that just getting the signal at least at one point of the day to get the carbs without the
Or the insulin release without protein, so you could take glycine as well, technically.
Yes.
But some.
But maybe technically it would be better to get a protein or a source of tryptophan at the same time.
Yeah. So oats or banana.
Or a banana.
Pre-workout banana or oats.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that, or post-workout banana even.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so it's a messy thing. There is definitely not clear data showing that this is how you should eat your tryptophan and LNAs, and this is how much carbs, and this is the timing.
I guess these most simplest way is to just spike your insulin.
Well, not necessarily spike. You just need the insulin.
Increase it a little bit.
Increase it.
Glycine doesn't spike it, but it does release it a little bit.
Yes, and many people supplement with BCAAs, which then can, of course, harm this process a bit. But instead of just like stopping to eating BCAAs, that's not a good idea either, because it's actually shown that BCAA depletion is linked to depression and anxiety.
Mm.
So when it's a complete protein, we probably need all of these things to support our body, the processes in the body.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just like how to kind of not to get too much of something chronically all the time and with the lack of the other things. Maybe here, if someone takes BCAAs, I would say that try to, for example, time them before exercise.
Mm.
So then your body is using the BCAAs.
Yeah, and I mean, they're used for like energy production as well. So.
And eating them towards the beginning of the day rather than towards the evening. So in the evening, focus on the carbs. And then another thing here is that, as talked, when tryptophan goes into the brain, it also goes into the kynurenine pathway, majority of it that goes there. Kynurenine pathway is something that helps you to cope with stress. And if you have a high activity of the kynurenine pathway, the tryptophan into the 5-HT pathway, so for your sleep and melatonin and mood and all of those benefits would be lower. So it's shown that when you have a lot of gut inflammation or inflammation in general cellular or physiological or psychological stress, the tryptophan is going there more. So correcting inflammation, gut microbiome disturbances and stuff like this would be important for the tryptophan to actually be also used for the serotonin in the brain. So yeah, here we have covered a lot of tips for exercise, diet, and neurotransmitter balance for women and for men as well. And do you have anything to add at this point? Or
check out like part one if you're this is your first video, and that's gonna give more like reference as well.
Yeah, these two videos really complement each other. So thanks for listening. Comment below of your thoughts, what you think, what you have noticed in your own exercise routine or protein intake or diet, what is working for you and what is not. Would be really interesting to hear your thoughts. And make sure to check next week's episode as well. And make sure to click the subscribe button on whichever corner it is, that side. There you can find it. See you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Mind and Psychology podcast today. I'd love to hear what really spoke to you in today's episode, so let me know in the YouTube comments in youtube.com/@IamIngaLand. If you want to learn more about the topics of mind and psychology, subscribe to YouTube and Apple Podcasts to stay up to date on new episodes. Have a good day and see you next week at the same place.